It's not necessary. Still, however, you have found me out. There must be something good in the feeling that has brought you here, and I will not repulse you, but surely you must understand, My attention was so attracted by the singularity of his fixed look at me that the words died away on my tongue.
"You was a-saying,"
he observed, when we had confronted one another in silence,
"that surely I must understand. What, surely, must I understand?"
"That I cannot wish to renew that chance intercourse with you of long ago under these different circumstances. I am glad to believe you have repented and recovered yourself. I am glad to tell you so. I am glad that, thinking I deserve to be thanked, you have come to thank me, but our ways are different ways, nonetheless. You are wet, and you look weary. Will you drink something before you go?" He had replaced his neckerchief loosely, and had stood keenly observant of me, biting a long end of it.
"I think,"
he answered, still with the end at his mouth, and still observant of me,
"that I will drink, I thank you, afore I go."
There was a tray ready on a side table. I brought it to the table near the fire, and asked him what he would have. He touched one of the bottles, without looking at it or speaking, and I made him some hot rum and water. I tried to keep my hands steady while I did so, but his look at me as he leaned back in his chair, with the long, draggled end of his neckerchief between his teeth, evidently forgotten, made my hand very difficult to master. When at last I put the glass to him, I saw with amazement that his eyes were full of tears. Up to this time I had remained standing, not to disguise that I wished him gone, but I was softened by the softened aspect of the man, and felt a touch of reproach. "I hope," said I, hurriedly putting something into a glass for myself and drawing a chair to the table, "that you will not think I spoke harshly to you just now. I had no intention of doing it, and I'm sorry for it if I did. I wish you well and happy." As I put my glass to my lips, he glanced with surprise at the end of his neckerchief, dropping from his mouth when he opened it, and stretched out his hand. I gave him mine, and then he drank, and drew his sleeve across his eyes and forehead. "How have you been living?" I asked him.
"I've been a sheep farmer, stock breeder, other trades, besides away in the New World," said he. "Many a thousand mile of stormy water off from this."
"I hope you have done well."
"I've done wonderful well. There's others went out along o' me as has done well too, but no man has done nigh as well as me. I'm famous for it."
"I'm glad to hear it."
"I hope to hear you say so, my dear boy."
Without stopping to try to understand those words or the tone in which they were spoken, I turned off to a point that had just come into my mind. "Have you ever seen a messenger you once sent to me?" I inquired, "since he undertook that trust."
"Never set eyes upon him. I weren't likely to it."
"He came faithfully, and he brought me the 2 1-pound notes. I was a poor boy then, as you know, and to a poor boy they were a little fortune. But like you, I have done well since, and you must let me pay them back. You can put them to some other poor boy's use." I took out my purse. He watched me as I laid my purse upon the table and opened it, and he watched me as I separated 2 1-pound notes from its contents. They were clean and new, and I spread them out and handed them over to him. Still watching me, he laid them one upon the other, folded them longwise, gave them a twist, set fire to them at the lamp, and dropped the ashes into the tray.
"May I make so bold?"
he said then, with a smile that was like a frown and with a frown that was like a smile.
"As ask you how you have done well, since you and me was out on them lone shivery marshes."
"How?"
"Ah."
He emptied his glass, got up and stood at the side of the fire, with his heavy brown hand on the mantel shelf. He put a foot up to the bars to dry and warm it, and the wet boot began to steam. But he neither looked at it nor at the fire, but steadily looked at me. It was only now that I began to tremble. When my lips had parted and had shaped some words that were without sound, I forced myself to tell him, though I could not do it distinctly, that I had been chosen to succeed to some property.
"My Amir Muhammad, ask what property?"
said he. I faltered. "I don't know."
"Might Amir Muhammad ask whose property?"
said he. I faltered again. "I don't know."
"Could I make a guess, I wonder?"
said the convict.
"At your income since you come of age, as to the first figure now." "Five?"
With my heart beating like a heavy hammer of disordered action, I rose out of my chair and stood with my hand upon the back of it, looking wildly at him.
"Concerning a guardian,"
he went on,
"there ought to have been some guardian or such like whilst you was a minor. Some lawyer, maybe. As to the first letter of that lawyer's name now, would it be J?"
All the truth of my position came flashing on me, and its disappointments, dangers, disgraces, consequences of all kinds rushed in such a multitude that I was borne down by them and had to struggle for every breath I drew.
"Put it," he resumed, "as the employer of that lawyer whose name began with a J and might be Jaggers. Put it as he had come oversea to Portsmouth and had landed there and had wanted to come on to you. However, you have found me out, you says just now. Well, however did I find you out? Why, I wrote from Portsmouth to a person in London for particulars of your address. That person's name? Why, Wemmick."
I could not have spoken one word, though it had been to save my life. I stood with a hand on the chair back and a hand on my breast, where I seemed to be suffocating. I stood so, looking wildly at him, until I grasped at the chair, when the room began to surge and turn. He caught me, drew me to the sofa, put me up against the cushions, and bent on one knee before me, bringing the face that I now well remembered and that I shuddered at, very near to mine.
"Yes, Pip, dear boy, I've made a gentleman on you. It's me what has done it. I swore that time, sure as ever I earned a guinea, that guinea should go to you. I swore afterwards, sure as ever I speculated and got rich, you should get rich. I lived rough, that you should live smooth. I worked hard, that you should be above work. What odds, dear boy? Do I tell it for you to feel an obligation? Not a bit. I tell it for you to know, as that there hunted dung-eel dog, what you kept life in, got his head so high that he could make a gentleman. And, Pip, you're him."
The abhorrence in which I held the man, the dread I had of him, the repugnance with which I shrank from him, could not have been exceeded if he had been some terrible beast.
"Looky here, Pip. I'm your second father. You're my son. More to me nor any son. I've put away money only for you to spend. When I was a hired-out shepherd in a solitary hut, not seeing no faces but faces of sheep till I half forgot what men's and women's faces was like, I see yourn. I drops my knife many a time in that hut when I was eating my dinner or supper, and I says, 'Here's the boy again, a-looking at me while I eats and drinks.' I see you there a many times as plain as ever I see you on them misty marshes. 'Lord, strike me dead,' I says each time. And I goes out in the open air to say it under the open heavens. But what if I get liberty and money, I'll make that boy a gentleman. And I done it. Why, look at you, dear boy. Look at these here lodgings of yourn, fit for a lord. A lord, You shall show money with lords for wages, and beat 'em."
In his heat and triumph, and in his knowledge that I had been nearly fainting, he did not remark on my reception of all this. It was the one grain of relief I had.
"Looky here,"
he went on, taking my watch out of my pocket, and turning towards him a ring on my finger, while I recoiled from his touch as if it had been a snake.
"A golden and a beauty. That's a gentleman's, I hope. A diamond all set round with rubies. That's a gentleman's, I hope. Look at your linen, fine and beautiful. Look at your clothes, Better ain't to be got, and your books too.
Turning his eyes round the room.
Mounting up on their shelves by hundreds. And you read 'em, don't you? I see you've been a-reading of 'em when I come in. You shall read 'em to me, dear boy. And if they're in foreign languages what I don't understand, I shall be just as proud as if I did.
Again he took both my hands and put them to his lips, while my blood ran cold within me.
"Don't you mind talking, Pip," said he,
after again drawing his sleeve over his eyes and forehead, as the click came in his throat, which I well remembered, and he was all the more horrible to me that he was so much in earnest.
"You can't do better, nor keep quiet, dear boy. You ain't looked slowly forward to this as I have. You wasn't prepared for this as I was. But didn't you never think it might be me?"
"Oh, no. No, no," I returned. "Never, never."
"Well, you see, it was me, and single-handed. Never a soul in it but my own self and Mr. Jaggers."
"Was there no one else?" I asked.
"No," said he with a glance of surprise. "Who else should there be? And, dear boy, how good-looking you've grown. There's bright eyes somewheres, eh? Isn't there bright eyes somewheres, what you love the thoughts on?"
"Oh, Estella, Estella."
"They shall be yourn, dear boy, if money can buy 'em. Not that a gentleman like you, so well set up as you, can win 'em off his own game. But money shall back you. Let me finish what I was telling you, dear boy. From that there hut, and that there hiring out, I got money left me by my master, which died and had been the same as me, and got my liberty, and went for myself. In every single thing I went for you. Lord, strike a blight upon it, I says, whatever it was I went for, if it ain't for him. It all prospered wonderful. As I'll give you to understand just now, I'm famous for it. It was the money he left me, and the gains of the first few years what I sent home to Mr. Jaggers. All for you. When he first come out of you, agreeable to my letter.
Oh, that he had never come. That he had left me at the forge, far from contented, yet by comparison happy.
And then, dear boy, it was a recompense to me. Looky here, to know in secret that I was making up a gentleman. The blood horses of them colonists might fling up the dust o'er me as I was walking. What do I say? I says to myself, I'm making a better gentleman nor ever you'll be. When one of them says to another, he was a convict a few years ago, and is a ignorant common fellow now for all he's lucky. What do I say? I says to myself, if I ain't a gentleman, nor yet ain't got no learning, I'm the owner of such. All on you owns stock and land. Which on you owns a brought-up London gentleman? This way I kept myself a-going. This way I held steady afore my mind that I would for certain come one day and see my boy, and make myself known to him on his own ground.
He laid his hand on my shoulder. I shuddered at the thought that for anything I knew his hand might be stained with blood.
It weren't easy, Pip, for me to leave them parts, nor yet it wasn't safe. But I held to it, and the harder it was, the stronger I held, for I was determined, and my mind firm made up. At last I done it, dear boy. I done it.
I tried to collect my thoughts, but I was stunned. Throughout, I had seemed to myself to attend more to the wind and the rain than to him. Even now, I could not separate his voice from those voices, though those were loud and his was silent.
"Where will you put me?" he asked presently. "I must be put somewheres, dear boy."
"To sleep," said I.
"Yes, and to sleep long and sound," he answered, "for I've been sea-tossed and sea-washed months and months."
My friend and companion," said I, rising from the sofa, "is absent. You must have his room."
"He won't come back tomorrow, will he?"
"No," said I, answering almost mechanically, in spite of my utmost efforts. "Not tomorrow."
"Because, looky here, dear boy," he said,
dropping his voice and laying a long finger on my breast in an impressive manner.
"Caution is necessary."
"How do you mean, caution?"
"By God, it's death.
What's death?
I was sent for life. It's death to come back. There's been overmuch coming back of late years, and I should of a certainty be hanged if took.
Nothing was needed but this. The wretched man, after loading me with his wretched gold and silver chains for years, had risked his life to come to me, and I held it there in my keeping. If I had loved him instead of abhorring him, if I had been attracted to him by the strongest admiration and affection, instead of shrinking from him with the strongest repugnance, it could have been no worse. On the contrary, it would have been better, for his preservation would then have naturally and tenderly addressed my heart. My first care was to close the shutters, so that no light might be seen from without, and then to close and make fast the doors. While I did so, he stood at the table, drinking rum and eating biscuit, and when I saw him thus engaged, I saw my convict on the marshes at his meal again. It almost seemed to me as if he must stoop down presently to file at his leg. When I had gone into Herbert's room, and had shut off any other communication between it and the staircase than through the room in which our conversation had been held, I asked him if he would go to bed. He said yes, but asked me for some of my gentleman's linen to put on in the morning. I brought it out and laid it ready for him, and my blood again ran cold, when he again took me by both hands to give me good night. I got away from him without knowing how I did it, and mended the fire in the room where we had been together, and sat down by it, afraid to go to bed. For an hour or more I remained too stunned to think, and it was not until I began to think that I began fully to know how wrecked I was, and how the ship in which I had sailed was gone to pieces. Miss Havisham's intentions toward me, all a mere dream. Estella not designed for me. I only suffered in Satis House as a convenience, a sting for the greedy relations, a model with a mechanical heart to practice on when no other practice was at hand. Those were the first smarts I had. But sharpest and deepest pain of all, it was for the convict, guilty of I knew not what crimes, and liable to be taken out of those rooms where I sat thinking and hanged at the Old Bailey door, that I had deserted Joe. I would not have gone back to Joe now. I would not have gone back to Biddy now, for any consideration. Simply, I suppose, because my sense of my own worthless conduct to them was greater than every consideration. No wisdom on earth could have given me the comfort that I should have derived from their simplicity and fidelity. But I could never, never, never undo what I had done. In every rage of wind and rush of rain, I heard pursuers. Twice I could have sworn there was a knocking and whispering at the outer door. With these fears upon me, I began either to imagine or recall that I had had mysterious warnings of this man's approach, that for weeks gone by I had passed faces in the streets which I had thought like his, that these likenesses had grown more numerous as he, coming over the sea, had drawn nearer, that his wicked spirit had somehow sent these messages to mine, and that now, on this stormy night, he was as good as his word, and with me. Crowding up with these reflections came the reflection that I had seen him with my childish eyes to be a desperately violent man, that I had heard that other convict reiterate that he had tried to murder him, that I had seen him down in the ditch, tearing and fighting like a wild beast. Out of such remembrances I brought into the light of the fire a half-formed terror that it might not be safe to be shut up there with him in the dead of the wild, solitary night. This dilated until it filled the room, and impelled me to take a candle and go in and look at my dreadful burden. He had rolled a handkerchief round his head, and his face was set and lowering in his sleep. But he was asleep, and quietly too, though he had a pistol lying on the pillow. Assured of this, I softly removed the key to the outside of his door, and turned it on him before I again sat down by the fire. Gradually I slipped from the chair, and lay on the floor. When I awoke, without having parted in my sleep with the perception of my wretchedness, the clocks of the eastward churches were striking five. The candles were wasted out, the fire was dead, and the wind and rain intensified the thick black darkness. This is the end of the second stage of Pip's expectations. Chapter 40. It was fortunate for me that I had had to take precautions to ensure, so far as I could, the safety of my dreaded visitor, for this thought pressing on me when I awoke held other thoughts in a confused concourse at a distance. The impossibility of keeping him concealed in the chambers was self-evident. It could not be done, and the attempt to do it would inevitably engender suspicion. True, I had no avenger in my service now, but I was looked after by an inflammatory old female, assisted by an animated ragbag whom she called her niece, and to keep a room secret from them would be to invite curiosity and exaggeration. They both had weak eyes, which I had long attributed to their chronically looking in at keyholes, and they were always at hand when not wanted. Indeed, that was their only reliable quality, besides larceny. Not to get up a mystery with these people, I resolved to announce in the morning that my uncle had unexpectedly come from the country. This course I decided on while I was yet groping about in the darkness for the means of getting a light. Not stumbling on the means, after all, I was fain to go to the adjacent lodge and get the watchman there to come with his lantern. Now, in groping my way down the black staircase, I fell over something, and that something was a man crouching in a corner. As the man made no answer when I asked him what he did there, but eluded my touch in silence, I ran to the lodge and urged the watchman to come quickly, telling him of the incident on the way back. The wind being as fierce as ever, we did not care to endanger the light in the lantern by rekindling the extinguished lamps on the staircase, but we examined the staircase from the bottom to the top, and found no one there. It then occurred to me as possible that the man might have slipped into my rooms, so lighting my candle at the watchman's and leaving him standing at the door, I examined them carefully, including the room in which my dreaded guest lay asleep. All was quiet, and assuredly no other man was in those chambers. It troubled me that there should have been a lurker on the stairs on that night of all nights in the year, and I asked the watchman, on the chance of eliciting some hopeful explanation as I handed him a dram at the door, whether he had admitted at his gate any gentleman who had perceptibly been dining out. "Yes," he said, "at different times of the night, three. One lived in Fountain Court, and the other two lived in the lane, and he had seen them all go home. Again, the only other man who dwelt in the house of which my chambers formed a part had been in the country for some weeks, and he certainly had not returned in the night, because we had seen his door with his seal on it as we came upstairs."
"The night being so bad, sir," said the watchman, as he gave me back my glass, "uncommon few have come in at my gate. Besides them three gentlemen that I've named, I don't call to mind another since about 11 o'clock, when a stranger asked for you."
"My uncle," I muttered. "Yes."
"You saw him, sir?"
"Oh, yes, oh, yes."
"Likewise the person with him?"
"Person with him," I repeated.
"Well, I judged the person to be with him," returned the watchman. "The person stopped when he stopped to make inquiry of me, and the person took this way when he took this way."
"What sort of person?" The watchman had not particularly noticed. He should say a working person. To the best of his belief, he had a dust-coloured kind of clothes on, under a dark coat. The watchman made more light of the matter than I did, naturally, not having my reason for attaching weight to it. When I had got rid of him, which I thought it well to do without prolonging explanations, my mind was much troubled by these two circumstances taken together. Whereas they were easy of innocent solution apart, as, for instance, some diner-out or diner-at-home who had not gone near his watchman's gate might have strayed to my staircase and dropped asleep there, and my nameless visitor might have brought someone with him to show him the way. Still joined, they had an ugly look to one as prone to distrust and fear as the changes of a few hours had made me. I lighted my fire, which burnt with a raw pale flare at that time of the morning, and fell into a doze before it. I seemed to have been dozing a whole night when the clock struck six. As there was a full hour and a half between me and daylight, I dozed again, now waking up uneasily with prolix conversations about nothing in my ears, now making thunder of the wind in the chimney, at length falling off into a profound sleep from which the daylight woke me with a start. All this time I had never been able to consider my own situation, nor could I do so yet. I had not the power to attend to it. I was greatly dejected and distressed, but in an incoherent, wholesale sort of way. As to forming any plan for the future, I could as soon have formed an elephant. When I opened the shutters and looked out at the wet, wild morning, all of a leaden hue, when I walked from room to room, when I sat down again, shivering, before the fire, waiting for my laundress to appear, I thought how miserable I was, but hardly knew why, or how long I had been so, or on what day of the week I made the reflection, or even who I was that made it. At last the old woman and the niece came in, the latter with a head not easily distinguished from her dusty broom, and testified surprise at the sight of me in the fire, to whom I imparted how my uncle had come in the night and was then asleep, and how the breakfast preparations were to be modified accordingly. Then I washed and dressed while they knocked the furniture about and made a dust. And so, in a sort of dream or sleep-waking, I found myself sitting by the fire again, waiting for him to come to breakfast. By and by, his door opened, and he came out. I could not bring myself to bear the sight of him, and thought he had a worse look by daylight. "I do not even know," said I, speaking low as he took his seat at the table, "by what name to call you. I have given up that you are my uncle."
"That's it, dear boy. Call me uncle."
"You assume some name, I suppose, on board ship?"
"Yes, dear boy. I took the name of Provis."
"Do you mean to keep that name?"
"Why, yes, dear boy. It's as good as another, unless you'd like another."
"What is your real name?" I asked him in a whisper.
"Magwitch,"
he answered in the same tone.
"Christened Abel."
"What were you brought up to be?"
"A warmint, dear boy."
He answered quite seriously, and used the word as if it denoted some profession. "When you came into the temple last night," said I, pausing to wonder whether that could really have been last night, which seemed so long ago.
"Yes, dear boy."
"When you came in at the gate and asked the watchman the way here, had you anyone with you?"
"With me? No, dear boy."
"But there was someone there."
"Well, I didn't take particular notice," he said dubiously, "not knowing the ways of the place. But I think there was a person, too, come in along o' me."
"Are you known in London?"
"I hope not,"
said he, giving his neck a jerk with his forefinger that made me turn hot and sick. "Were you known in London once?"
"Not over and above, dear boy. I was in the provinces, mostly."
"Were you tried in London?"
"Which time?"
said he with a sharp look. "The last time." He nodded.
"First knowed Mr. Jaggers that way. Jaggers was for me."
It was on my lips to ask him what he was tried for, but he took up a knife, gave it a flourish, and with the words,
"And what I done is worked out and paid for,"
and fell to at his breakfast. He ate in a ravenous way that was very disagreeable, and all his actions were uncouth, noisy, and greedy. Some of his teeth had failed him since I saw him eat on the marshes, and as he turned his food in his mouth and turned his head sideways to bring his strongest fangs to bear upon it, he looked terribly like a hungry old dog. If I had begun with any appetite, he would have taken it away, and I should have sat, much as I did, repelled from him by an insurmountable aversion, and gloomily looking at the cloth.
"I'm a heavy grubber, dear boy,"
he said, as a polite kind of apology, when he had made an end of his meal.
"I always was. If it had been in my constitution to be a lighter grubber, I might have got into lighter trouble. Similarly, I must have my smoke. When I was first hired out as a shepherd t'other side of the world, it's my belief I should have turned into a melancholy mad sheep myself if I hadn't had my smoke."
As he said so, he got up from the table, and putting his hand into the breast of the peacoat he wore, brought out a short black pipe and a handful of loose tobacco, of the kind that is called negro head. Having filled his pipe, he put the surplus tobacco back again, as if his pocket were a drawer. Then he took a live coal from the fire with the tongs, and lighted his pipe at it, and then turned round on the hearth rug with his back to the fire, and went through his favourite action of holding out both hands for mine.
"And this?" said he,
dandling my hands up and down in his as he puffed at his pipe.
"And this is the gentleman what I made, the real genuine one. It does me good for to look at you, Pip. All I stipulate is to stand by and look at you, dear boy."
I released my hands as soon as I could, and found that I was beginning slowly to settle down to the contemplation of my condition. What I was chained to, and how heavily, became intelligible to me, as I heard his hoarse voice, and sat looking up at his furrowed bald head, with its iron-grey hair at the sides.
"I mustn't see my gentleman a-footing it in the mire of the streets. There mustn't be no mud on his boots. My gentleman must have horses, Pip. Horses to ride, and horses to drive, and horses for his servant to ride and drive as well. Shall colonists have their horses and bloodens, if you please, good lord, and not my London gentleman? No, no. We'll show him another pair of shoes than that, Pip, won't us?"
He took out of his pocket a great thick pocket-book, bursting with papers, and tossed it on the table.
"There's something worth spending in that there book, dear boy. It's yourn. All I got ain't mine. It's yourn. And you'll be afeard on it. There's more where that come from. I've come to the old country for to see my gentleman spend his money like a gentleman. That'll be my pleasure. My pleasure it'll be for to see him do it. And blast you all,"
he wound up, looking round the room and snapping his fingers once with a loud snap,
"blast you everyone, from the judge and his wig to the colonists a-stirring up the dust. I'll show a better gentleman than the whole kit on you put together."
"Stop," said I, almost in a frenzy of fear and dislike. I want to speak to you. I want to know what is to be done. I want to know how you are to be kept out of danger, how long you're going to stay, what projects you have."
"Looky here, Pip,"
said he, laying his hand on my arm in a suddenly altered and subdued manner.
"First of all, looky here. I forgot myself half a minute ago. What I said was low. That's what it was. Low. Looky here, Pip. Look over it. It ain't going to be low."
"First," I resumed, half groaning, "what precautions can be taken against your being recognized and seized?"
"No, dear boy,"
he said in the same tone as before.
"That don't go first. Lowness goes first. I ain't took so many a year to make a gentleman, not without knowing what's due to him. Look here, Pip. I was low. That's what I was. Low. Look over it, dear boy."
Some sense of the grimly ludicrous moved me to a fretful laugh, as I replied, "I have looked over it. In heaven's name, don't harp upon it."
"Yes, but looky here," he persisted. "Dear boy, I ain't come so fur, not fur to be low. Ah, go on, dear boy. You was a-saying—"
"How are you to be guarded from the danger you have incurred?"
"Oh, dear boy, the danger ain't so great. Without I was informed again, the danger ain't so much to signify. There's Jaggers, and there's Wemmick, and there's you. Who else is there to inform?"
"There is no chance person who might identify you in the street," said I.
"Well," he returned, "there ain't many. Nor yet I don't intend to advertise myself in the newspapers by the name of A.M. come back from Botany Bay. And years have rolled away, and who's to gain by it? Still, look here, Pip. If the danger had been 50 times as great, I should have come to see you, mind you, just the same."
"And how long do you remain?"
"How long?"
said he, taking his black pipe from his mouth and dropping his jaw as he stared at me.
"I'm not a-going back. I've come for good."
"Where are you to live?" said I. "What is to be done with you? Where will you be safe?"
"Dear boy," he returned, "there's disguising wigs can be bought for money, and there's hair powder and spectacles and black clothes, shorts and what not. Others have done it safe afore, and what others has done afore, others can do again. As to the where and how of living, dear boy, give me your own opinions on it."
"You take it smoothly now," said I, "but you were very serious last night when you swore it was death."
"And so I swear it is death," said he, putting his pipe back in his mouth. "And death by the rope, in the open street, not far from this. And it's serious that you should fully understand it to be so. What then, when that's done? Here I am. To go back now, it'd be as bad as to stand ground. Worse. Besides, Pip, I'm here because I've meant it by you. Years and years. As to what I dare, I'm an old bird now, as has dared all manner of traps since first he was fledged, and I'm not afeard to perch upon a scarecrow. If there's death hid inside of it, there is, and let him come out, and I'll face him, and then I'll believe in him and not afore. But now let me have a look at my gentleman again.
Once more he took me by both hands, and surveyed me with an air of admiring proprietorship, smoking with great complacency all the while. It appeared to me that I could do no better than secure him some quiet lodging hard by, of which he might take possession when Herbert returned, whom I expected in 2 or 3 days, that the secret must be confided to Herbert as a matter of unavoidable necessity, even if I could have put the immense relief I should derive from sharing it with him out of the question, was plain to me. But it was by no means so plain to Mr. Provis. I resolved to call him by that name, who reserved his consent to Herbert's participation until he should have seen him and formed a favourable judgment of his physiognomy.
"And even then, dear boy,"
he said, pulling a greasy little clasped black testament out of his pocket,
"we'll have him on his oath."
To state that my terrible patron carried this little black book about the world solely to swear people on in cases of emergency would be to state what I never quite established. But this I can say, that I never knew him put it to any other use. The book itself had the appearance of having been stolen from some court of justice, and perhaps his knowledge of its antecedents, combined with his own experience in that wise, gave him a reliance on its powers as a sort of legal spell or charm. On this first occasion of his producing it, I recalled how he had made me swear fidelity in the churchyard long ago, and how he had described himself last night as always swearing to his resolutions in his solitude. As he was at present dressed in a seafaring slop-suit, in which he looked as if he had some parrots and cigars to dispose of, I next discussed with him what dress he should wear. He cherished an extraordinary belief in the virtues of shorts as a disguise, and had in his own mind sketched a dress for himself that would have made him something between a dean and a dentist. It was with considerable difficulty that I won him over to the assumption of a dress more like a prosperous farmer's, and we arranged that he should cut his hair close and wear a little powder. Lastly, as he had not yet been seen by the laundress or her niece, he was to keep himself out of their view until his change of dress was made. It would seem a simple matter to decide on these precautions, but in my dazed, not to say distracted state, it took so long that I did not get out to further them until 2 or 3 in the afternoon. He was to remain shut up in the chambers while I was gone, and was on no account to open the door. There being, to my knowledge, a respectable lodging-house in Essex Street, the back of which looked into the temple, and was almost within hail of my windows, I first of all repaired to that house, and was so fortunate as to secure the second floor for my uncle, Mr. Provis. I then went from shop to shop, making such purchases as were necessary to the change in his appearance. This business transacted, I turned my face on my own account to Little Britain. Mr. Jaggers was at his desk, but seeing me enter, got up immediately and stood before the fire.
"Now, Pip," said he, "be careful."
"I will, sir," I returned, for coming along I had thought well of what I was going to say.
"Don't commit yourself,"
said Mr. Jaggers.
"And don't commit any one. You understand? Any one. Don't tell me anything. I don't want to know anything. I am not curious."
Of course I saw that he knew the man was come. "I merely want, Mr. Jaggers," said I, "to assure myself what I have been told is true. I have no hope of its being untrue, but at least I may verify it." Mr. Jaggers nodded.
"But did you say told or informed?"
he asked me, with his head on one side, and not looking at me, but looking in a listening way at the floor.
"Told would seem to apply verbal communication. You can't have verbal communication with a man in New South Wales, you know.
I will say informed, Mr. Jaggers.
Good.
I have been informed by a person named Abel Magwitch that he is the benefactor so long unknown to me.
That is the man, said Mr. Jaggers. In New South Wales.
And only he, said I.
And only he, said Mr. Jaggers.
I am not so unreasonable, sir, as to think you at all responsible for my mistakes and wrong conclusions, but I always supposed it was Miss Havisham.
As you say, Pip,
returned Mr. Jaggers, turning his eyes upon me coolly and taking a bite at his forefinger.
I am not at all responsible for that.
And yet it looks so like it, sir, I pleaded with a downcast heart.
Not a particle of evidence, Pip,
said Mr. Jaggers, shaking his head and gathering up his skirts.
Take nothing on its looks. Take everything on evidence. There's no better rule.
I have no more to say, said I with a sigh, after standing silent for a little while. I have verified my information, and there's an end.
And Magwitch, in New South Wales, having at last disclosed himself, said Mr. Jaggers, you will comprehend, Pip, how rigidly throughout my communication with you I have always adhered to the strict line of fact. There has never been the least departure from the strict line of fact. You are quite aware of that.
Quite, sir.
I communicated to Magwitch in New South Wales, when he first wrote to me from New South Wales, the caution that he must not expect me to ever deviate from the strict line of fact. I also communicated to him another caution. He appeared to me to have obscurely hinted in his letter at some distant idea of seeing you in England here. I cautioned him that I must hear no more of that, that he was not at all likely to obtain a pardon, that he was expatriated for the term of his natural life, and that his presenting himself in this country would be an act of felony, rendering him liable to the extreme penalty of the law. I gave Magwitch that caution, said Mr. Jaggers, looking hard at me. I wrote it to New South Wales. He guided himself by it, no doubt.
No doubt, said I.
I have been informed by Wemmick, pursued Mr. Jaggers, still looking hard at me, that he has received a letter under date Portsmouth from a colonist of the name of Purvis,
or Provis, I suggested.
Or Provis, thank you, Pip. Perhaps it is Provis. Perhaps you know it's Provis.
Yes, said I.
You know it's Provis. A letter under date Portsmouth from a colonist of the name of Provis, asking for the particulars of your address on behalf of Magwitch. Wemmick sent him the particulars, I understand, by return of post. Probably it is through Provis that you have received the explanation of Magwitch in New South Wales.
It came through Provis, I replied.
Good day, Pip, said Mr. Jaggers, offering his hand. Glad to have seen you. In writing by post to Magwitch in New South Wales, or in communicating with him through Provis, have the goodness to mention that the particulars and vouchers of our long account shall be sent to you together with the balance, for there is still a balance remaining. Good day, Pip.
We shook hands, and he looked hard at me as long as he could see me. I turned at the door, and he was still looking hard at me, while the two vile casts on the shelf seemed to be trying to get their eyelids open and force out their swollen throats. Oh, what a man he is! Wemmick was out, and though he had been at his desk, he could have done nothing for me. I went straight back to the temple, where I found the terrible Provis drinking rum and water and smoking negro head in safety. Next day, the clothes I had ordered all came home, and he put them on. Whatever he put on became him less, it dismally seemed to me, than what he had worn before. To my thinking, there was something in him that made it hopeless to attempt to disguise him. The more I dressed him, and the better I dressed him, the more he looked like the slouching fugitive on the marshes. This effect on my anxious fancy was partly referable, no doubt, to his old face and manner growing more familiar to me. But I believe, too, that he dragged one of his legs as if there were still a weight of iron on it, and that from head to foot there was convict in the very grain of the man. The influences of his solitary hut life were upon him besides, and gave him a savage air that no dress could tame. Added to these were the influences of his subsequent branded life among men, and crowning all, his consciousness that he was dodging and hiding now. In all his ways of sitting and standing and eating and drinking, of brooding about in a high-shouldered, reluctant style, of taking out his great horn-handled jackknife and wiping it on his legs and cutting his food, of lifting light glasses and cups to his lips as if they were clumsy pannikins, of chopping off a wedge of his bread and soaking up with it the last fragments of gravy round and round his plate, as if to make the most of an allowance, and then drying his finger-ends on it, and then swallowing it. In these ways, and a thousand other small nameless instances arising every minute in the day, there was prisoner, felon, bondsman, plain as plain could be. It had been his own idea to wear that touch of powder, and I conceded the powder after overcoming the shorts, but I can compare the effect of it, when on, to nothing but the probable effect of rouge upon the dead. So awful was the manner in which everything in him that it was most desirable to repress started through that thin layer of pretense and seemed to come blazing out at the crown of his head. It was abandoned as soon as tried, and he wore his grizzled hair cut short. Words cannot tell what a sense I had at the same time of the dreadful mystery that he was to me. When he fell asleep of an evening with his knotted hands clenching the sides of the easy chair, and his bald head, tattooed with deep wrinkles, falling forward on his breast, I would sit and look at him, wondering what he had done, and loading him with all the crimes in the calendar, until the impulse was powerful on me to start up and fly from him. Every hour so increased my abhorrence of him that I even think I might have yielded to this impulse in the first agonies of being so haunted, notwithstanding all he had done for me and the risk he ran, but for the knowledge that Herbert must soon come back. Once I actually did start out of bed in the night, and began to dress myself in my worst clothes, hurriedly intending to leave him there with everything else I possessed, and enlist for India as a private soldier. I doubt if a ghost could have been more terrible to me, up in those lonely rooms in the long evenings and long nights, with the wind and the rain always rushing by. A ghost would not have been taken and hanged on my account, and the consideration that he could be, and the dread that he would be, were no small addition to my horrors. When he was not asleep or playing a complicated kind of patience with a ragged pack of cards of his own, a game that I never saw before or since, and in which he recorded his winnings by sticking his jackknife into the table, when he was not engaged in either of these pursuits, he would ask me to read to him.
"Foreign language, dear boy."
While I complied, he, not comprehending a single word, would stand before the fire, surveying me with the air of an exhibitor, and I would see him, between the fingers of the hand with which I shaded my face, appealing in dumb show to the furniture to take notice of my proficiency. The imaginary student pursued by the misshapen creature he had impiously made was not more wretched than I, pursued by the creature who had made me, and recoiling from him with a stronger repulsion, the more he admired me and the fonder he was of me. This is written of, I am sensible, as if it had lasted a year. It lasted about 5 days. Expecting Herbert all the time, I dared not go out except when I took Provis for an airing after dark. At length, one evening when dinner was over and I had dropped into a slumber quite worn out, for my nights had been agitated and my rest broken by fearful dreams, I was roused by the welcome footstep on the staircase. Provis, who had been asleep too, staggered up at the noise I made, and in an instant I saw his jackknife shining in his hand. "Quiet! It's Herbert," I said, and Herbert came bursting in with the airy freshness of 600 miles of France upon him. "Handel, my dear fellow, how are you? And again, how are you? And again, how are you? I seem to have been gone a 12-month. Why, so I must have been, for you have grown quite thin and pale, Handel. My, oh, hello, I beg your pardon." He was stopped in his running on and in his shaking hands with me by seeing Provis. Provis, regarding him with a fixed attention, was slowly putting up his jackknife and groping in another pocket for something else. "Herbert, my dear friend," said I, shutting the double doors while Herbert stood staring and wondering, "something very strange has happened. This is a visitor of mine."
"It's all right, dear boy," said Provis, coming forward with his little clasped black book, and then addressing himself to Herbert. "Take it in your right hand. Lord, strike you dead on the spot if you split in any way somever. Kiss it."
"Do so, as he wishes it," I said to Herbert. So Herbert, looking at me with a friendly uneasiness and amazement, complied, and Provis, immediately shaking hands with him, said,
"Now you're on your oath, you know, and never believe me on mine if Pip shan't make a gentleman on you."
Chapter 41. In vain should I attempt to describe the astonishment and disquiet of Herbert when he and I and Provis sat down before the fire, and I recounted the whole of the secret. Enough that I saw my own feelings reflected in Herbert's face, and not least among them my repugnance towards the man who had done so much for me. What would alone have set a division between that man and us, if there had been no other dividing circumstance, was his triumph in my story. Saving his troublesome sense of having been low on one occasion since his return, on which point he began to hold forth to Herbert the moment my revelation was finished, he had no perception of the possibility of my finding any fault with my good fortune. His boast that he had made me a gentleman, and that he had come to see me support the character on his ample resources, was made for me quite as much as for himself, and that it was a highly agreeable boast to both of us, and that we must both be very proud of it, was a conclusion quite established in his own mind.
"Now looky here, Pip's comrade," he said to Herbert, after having discoursed for some time. "I know very well that once since I come back, for half a minute, I've been low. I said to Pip, 'I knowed as I've been low, but don't you fret yourself on that score. I ain't made Pip a gentleman, and Pip ain't a-going to make you a gentleman, not for me not to know what's due to you both. Dear boy and Pip's comrade, you two may count upon me always having a genteel muzzle on. Muzzled I've been since that half-minute when I was betrayed into lowness. Muzzled I am at the present time. Muzzled I ever will be.'
Herbert said, 'Certainly,' but looked as if there were no specific consolation in this, and remained perplexed and dismayed. We were anxious for the time when he would go to his lodging and leave us together, but he was evidently jealous of leaving us together, and sat late. It was midnight before I took him round to Essex Street, and saw him safely in at his own dark door. When it closed upon him, I experienced the first moment of relief I had known since the night of his arrival. Never quite free from an uneasy remembrance of the man on the stairs, I had always looked about me in taking my guest out after dark, and in bringing him back, and I looked about me now. Difficult as it is in a large city to avoid the suspicion of being watched when the mind is conscious of danger in that regard, I could not persuade myself that any of the people within sight cared about my movements. The few who were passing passed on their several ways, and the street was empty when I turned back into the temple. Nobody had come out at the gate with us. Nobody went in at the gate with me. As I crossed by the fountain, I saw his lighted back windows looking bright and quiet, and when I stood for a few moments in the doorway of the building where I lived, before going up the stairs, Garden Court was as still and lifeless as the staircase was when I ascended it. Herbert received me with open arms, and I had never felt before so blessedly what it is to have a friend. When he had spoken some sound words of sympathy and encouragement, we sat down to consider the question. what was to be done. The chair that Provis had occupied still remaining where it had stood, for he had a barrack way with him of hanging about one spot, in one unsettled manner, and going through one round of observances with his pipe and his negro head and his jackknife and his pack of cards and what not, as if it were all put down for him on a slate. I say his chair remaining where it had stood. Herbert unconsciously took it, but next moment started out of it, pushed it away, and took another. He had no occasion to say after that that he had conceived an aversion for my patron. Neither had I occasion to confess my own. We interchanged that confidence without shaping a syllable. "What," said I to Herbert, when he was safe in another chair, "what is to be done?" "My poor dear Handel," he replied, holding his head, "I'm too stunned to think." "So was I, Herbert, when the blow first fell. Still, something must be done. He is intent upon various new expenses, horses and carriages, and lavish appearances of all kinds. He must be stopped somehow." "You mean that you can't accept?" "How can I?" I interposed, as Herbert paused. "Think of him. Look at him." An involuntary shudder passed over both of us. "Yet I am afraid the dreadful truth is, Herbert, that he is attached to me, strongly attached to me. Was there ever such a fate?" "My poor dear Handel," Herbert repeated. "Then," said I, "after all, stopping short here, never taking another penny from him, think what I owe him already. Then again, I am heavily in debt, very heavily for me, who have now no expectations. And I've been bred to no calling, and I'm fit for nothing." "Well, well, well," Herbert remonstrated, "don't say fit for nothing. Well, what am I fit for? I know only one thing that I'm fit for, and that is to go for a soldier. And I might have gone, my dear Herbert, but for the prospect of taking counsel with your friendship and affection." Of course I broke down there, and of course Herbert, beyond seizing a warm grip of my hand, pretended not to know it. "Anyhow, my dear Handel," said he presently, "soldiering won't do. If you were to renounce this patronage and these favours, I suppose you would do with some faint hope of one day repaying what you have already had. Not very strong, that hope, if you went soldiering. Besides, it's absurd. You would be infinitely better in Clarica's house, small as it is. I'm working up towards a partnership, you know." Poor fellow, he little suspected with whose money. "But there is another question," said Herbert. "This is an ignorant, determined man who has long had one fixed idea. More than that, he seems to me, I may misjudge him, to be a man of a desperate and fierce character." "I know he is," I returned. "Let me tell you what evidence I have seen of it." And I told him what I had not mentioned in my narrative, of that encounter with the other convict. "See then," said Herbert. "Think of this. He comes here at the peril of his life for the realization of his fixed idea. In the moment of realization, after all his toil and waiting, you cut the ground from under his feet, destroy his idea, and make his gains worthless to him. Do you see nothing that he might do under the disappointment?" "I have seen it, Herbert, and dreamed of it, ever since the fatal night of his arrival. Nothing has been in my thoughts so distinctly as his putting himself in the way of being taken." "Then you may rely upon it," said Herbert, "that there will be a great danger of his doing it. That is his power over you as long as he remains in England, and that would be his reckless course if you forsook him." I was so struck by the horror of this idea, which had weighed upon me from the first, and the working out of which would make me regard myself in some sort as his murderer, that I could not rest in my chair but began pacing to and fro. I said to Herbert, meanwhile, that even if Provis were recognized and taken, in spite of himself, I should be wretched as the cause, however innocently. Yes, even though I was so wretched in having him at large and near me, and even though I would far rather have worked at the forge all the days of my life than I would ever have come to this. But there was no staving off the question. What was to be done? "The first and main thing to be done," said Herbert, "is to get him out of England. You will have to go with him, and then he may be induced to go. But get him where I will, could I prevent his coming back?" "My God, Handel, Is it not obvious that with Newgate in the next street, there must be far greater hazard in your breaking your mind to him and making him reckless here than elsewhere? If a pretext to get him away could be made out of that other convict, or out of anything else in his life now...